shapers, we are change makers, we are potters spinning clay, we are dreamers of a new day. We are laughing, crying, we are taking the time to play, we are singing, we are sighing, we are making our own way. Politician, volunteer, refugee and engineer, in the streets and on the air, we are everywhere. We are world shapers, we are change makers, we are potters spinning clay, we are dreamers of a new day. We are rule breakers, we are homemakers, we are healers of the earth, we are midwives at the birth. We are women, and our place is in home.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Healing is good, too. My guest this morning is Cam Robbers, or Rob Cameron. You have a choice, but first we're going to be hearing the run-up, or the rundown, of this year's 10 best films, brought to you by Dan Persons. Stay tuned.
Thank you. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Yeah, the last part of the year could have ended better, and since we've known Schrodinger's president-elect would be walking into the White House, really, nobody knows what state that cat is in at any one time until we open up that particular Pandora's box, mixed metaphors, on January 20th. That's been occupying a lot of psychic space for everybody in the past couple of months. But it was an interesting year in film, with the typical mixed bag of Marvel films, Captain America Civil Wars was the best, X-Men whatever being the whatever, the expected crop of sequels and remakes, a few of which are worthy of note, and a few mainstream and indie efforts that demonstrate that original thinking and intelligence aren't completely dead in the industry. So let's run down my top 10 for the year of our Lord, 2016. First, one that doesn't quite place in the list, but is worthy of note, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. You had only to hear that title, based on a fancifully illustrated book by Ransom Riggs, and say, this has to be Tim Burton territory right here. And that turns out to be true, mostly. Burton's sense of sweet melancholy and his empathy for the odd and outcast of humanity suffuses the film, and there's tons of ravishing imagery, from a ghostly submerged ship to a floating peculiar child using her powers to rescue a baby squirrel to a troop of very Harryhausen-like skeleton warriors. Unfortunately, all of Tim Burton's weaknesses as a storyteller are here as well, and even though I'm told the film is largely faithful to the book, the more the narrative kicks in, the less mesmerizing the film becomes. Still, it is a beautiful trip, and for that reason, it is worth taking. And now, on to the top 10. Number 10, Don't Breathe. Director Fede Alvarez previously did the very credible Evil Dead remake/sequel, and here, once again under the producing eyes of Sam Raimi and Rob Tappert, delivers yet more nonstop horror thrills in this tale of a trio of young burglars who decide to rob the home of a blind man and discover that the bars on the guy's windows aren't necessarily to keep people out. Maybe Alvarez shoots past the mark toward the end, continuing to load in beats past a suitable stopping point. But there's no doubt that with his constantly mobile camera and inventive outlook, at one point he goes the total darkness sequence from Silence of the Lambs 7 steps better. The director knows how to keep you immersed in the action and simultaneously dreading and anticipating each outlandish moment. Number 9, The BFG. I've already had a few arguments about this pick, and it's maybe a marker of how weird a year this has been when Steven Spielberg releases a big-budget fantasy and it goes essentially unremarked. I get the sense that part of that is because people were disappointed that this is merely a lovely, visually dazzling adventure and not E.T. But come on, how many E.T.s do you think one man has in him? This is a very Miyazaki-like exercise for Spielberg, more about the moments than the plot. But the overall sweetness of the experience and Mark Rylance's engaging motion-capture performance as the big friendly giant make the BFG an entrancing experience. Number 8, Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. Another controversial pick, I guess, and maybe that's for the good. What I know is that, for me, director Gareth Edwards' subversion of the expected Star Wars mise-en-scene, his use of a largely non-Caucasian cast, and his confidence in letting this tale of a group of rebels stealing the plans for the Death Star, the very MacGuffin that would then be the motive engine of the original Star Wars, work its way to its own logical conclusion, made this feel less like another slice of franchise and more its own original and quite compelling beast. Number 7, April and the Extraordinary World. Easy enough to do steampunk. Like the song says, all you have to do is throw some gears on things and spray paint everything in antique bronze, and you're pretty much there. The challenge is to take a look at all that smoke-belching technology and divine the environmental havoc that would be wrought after just a few decades. That's the achievement accomplished by this French animated adventure by directors Christian Desmarres and Frank Akinci, in which a resourceful young woman discovers a conspiracy in which the fate of humanity hangs in the balance. The visual style is reminiscent of European comic books, and the world, in which trees have become a vanishing species offered up in museums and mammoth cable cars, are dispatched from between twin Eiffel Towers, balances between cautionary tale and wish fulfillment in a way that makes this wrought iron SF tale completely engaging. Number 6, Arrival. A lot of people are placing this higher on their lists. This spot feels about right for me. It is heartening to see an alien encounter film that isn't about scorched earth warfare, that treats how countries would cooperate and not cooperate in attempting to communicate with the visitors with a fair degree of realism, and that makes scientists and the scientific process the heroes of the hour. That the cast, chief among them leads Amy Adams, Jeremy Renner, Forrest Whitaker, and Michael Stuhlbarg, are great. That director Denis Villeneuve quotes from 2001 A Space Odyssey in both overt and covert ways, and then manages to incorporate the Kubrick masterpiece's attention to time as a storytelling element and make it emotionally impactful, makes this the rare, true SF film that you can think about and talk about for a long time afterwards. Number 5, Shin Godzilla. Co-director Hideaki Anno is no stranger to subversion. His anime series, Neon Genesis Evangelion, mixed giant robots with religious iconography and the psychosexual angst of teenagers, and the grand joke he whips up for the live-action Shin Godzilla is to take your standard kaiju setup, giant monster attacks Japan, and imagine how a real government bureaucracy would cope with the crisis. As much time, if not more, is taken up in anonymous meeting rooms as elected and appointed public servants with varying levels of competence do their level best to fight the monster, even as world governments, chief among them America, cast their own nuclear-armed shadow over the proceedings, as is devoted to documenting the destruction wrought by the King of Monsters. It's not as wildly farcical as Dr. Strangelove, to go back to the Kubrick well again, but its deadpan deconstruction of the world of giant monsters is almost as delicious. Number 4, Demon. An exorcist with real-world consequences, this Polish-Israeli co-production tells the tale of a bridegroom who on his wedding day is possessed by a Dybbuk, which turns out to be the dispossessed spirit of a young Jewish girl. In the process resurrecting certain aspects of a Polish village's past, like around the time of the Holocaust, say, that the inhabitants would rather not be reminded of. Director Marcin Rona's caustic eye captures the devolution of the wedding festivities as the older celebrants, including a priest with a less than steadfast commitment to his vows, are confronted with their long-denied culpability in genocide. The result combines black comedy with an indelibly insinuating horror. Number 3, Moana. This is the kind of Disney princess I want to see. Smart, resourceful, with a bodily form factor that at least nods towards the fact that most adult humans weigh a little more than 75 pounds. Throw in great songs by Lin-Manuel Miranda and a few other collaborators, wonderful voice performances by Dwayne Johnson and Jermaine Clement, along with a cast that, like those two, largely boast Pacific Island roots, and beautiful, luminous animation directed by Ron Clements and John Musker making their CG animation debut. And this is an adventure that's both emotionally engaging and a hell of a lot of fun. Number 2, Kubo and the Two Strings. This is a close tie with Moana, but this tale of a young storyteller on a mystical quest to find his father, a legendary ninja, accompanied by a sardonic monkey and a bumbling but steadfast beetle warrior voiced by Charlize Theron and Matthew McConaughey respectively, takes the edge for its beautiful stop-motion animation. Over at CineFantastique, we repeatedly invoke the phrase sense of wonder to describe what we're looking for in the films we cover. Kubo and the Two Strings is the very definition of that sense of wonder. Number 1, The Witch. Historical horror has never felt so real or so radical. Director Robert Eggers bases his story and a lot of his dialogue on actual 17th century accounts, and in telling the tale of a family of religious zealots who are either under assault from supernatural forces or may just be devolving into a morass of superstition, sexual repression, and madness, manages to conjure a sense of a world seen through the deluded eyes of its protagonists. Like the Babadook, The Witch is an original take on ancient fears, and a heartening demonstration that horror still has a few disturbing tricks left to play in its book. That's the 10, but we can't go without also highlighting the worst film I saw this year. Two of them in this case, since one isn't really genre but still has to be addressed. That would be Moonwalkers, which takes the hoary conspiracy theory notion that Stanley Kubrick was recruited by the CIA to fake the moon landing, and instead of coming up with grand farce, does absolutely nothing with it. But the actual genre nadir for me this year was Warcraft, another unusual pick, because it's not that it's such a horrible film, but given that it was directed by Duncan Jones, whose previous efforts, Moon and Source Code, showed a fertile and inventive mind, this attempt to adapt a video game to the screen only to wind up with something that was cliché-ridden when it wasn't outright incomprehensible represents a precipitous fall for the filmmaker. Hopefully, it's only temporary. Spielberg has his hook, after all. We'll look forward to your recovery, Duncan. And that's 2016. It's gone. It's over. Thank God. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Well, Dan, yes, I will say to you what I've been saying to myself and saying to many other people who've been saying, my God, was 2016 a sucky, sucky year? Oh my, yes it was in so many ways. But the thing that made it the suckiest was its foretelling of 2017 and possibly the next 4 years. Even if the incoming is ousted from being the incoming elect, which I'm guessing he will be. I'm guessing this character is going to be out of a job within 6 months. I'd even like to start a pool. That doesn't make it any better because his replacement is possibly worse because his replacement is a quarter of the way competent in politics. So I don't know which is worse. A blowhard who's incompetent, or a horrible human being who, in my opinion, who is somewhat competent because they can get their agendas through. The next 2 years are going to be tough. So thank God 2016 is over. Let us pray. I'm not a person who follows gods or goddesses much, but I believe in wishful thinking and prayer. Let us pray that 2017 is better. But I don't know. I don't know. In fact, at the very outset of the alternate universe we were thrust into after Election Day, as I was talking to people online about what can be done, I was talking with a group of people from the Brooklyn Science Fiction Writers Group. No? Oh, open your mouth and
talk. I can speak now.
Yeah. Yes. Well, actually, I'm not sure if you can because I'm not hearing you come up on the mic, but speak anyway.
Test one.
Tap your microphone. Yeah. It's one of these. Keep going. Keep tapping it.
We are called.
There we go.
Okay. There it is. We are called the Brooklyn Speculative Fiction Writers.
Ah, I beg your pardon.
Hello, everyone.
Minor difference. He goes teensy. It is teensy. because science fiction is a term all-encompassing. The term speculative fiction, when it was coined, was never intended to include fantasy or anything but hard SF.
But since that, just like any word,
it has morphed. It has morphed. It has been taken away from its, from the person who coined the term. Can you tell me who coined?
I'm going to resist Google, so you just go ahead and spill the beans.
Oh, his name is Robert Heinlein.
Thank you.
In the 1940s, people think spec fic is this new thing. Mm-hmm. It was coined by Heinlein in the 40s. And it got away from him very quickly, which is probably a good thing, because he was actually using it to narrow the field. And instead, others, including his own editors, took it to broaden the field. Sure. Because, as David Hartwell would say, why science fiction is the wrong and only name for it.
Well, for our purposes, and also as a classroom teacher, this naive understanding of what science fiction is, it's simply easier for us to say that science fiction is this thing that deals with aliens and the future, where fantasy is something else, where you'll get your dragons and your magic and those things that don't necessarily have to be explained as much. Speculative fiction, though, for those of us who now use, at least in our writers group, it allows for us to be a catch-all for all those things now.
Yeah, I, in the older tradition, I use science fiction as a catch-all. Mm. I tend to distinguish it from, say, body horror. But even a ghost story is science fiction to me.
Mm. See what happens in the next 10 years.
Because it's all one genre. Yeah.
We'll see what happens in 10 years. They switch places again.
Well, okay, you want to get technical?
Sure. People are getting education online.
It's all fantasy. Science fiction is a subgenre of fantasy.
How so?
Let's just deal with what is fantasy. It's stories of the imagination.
Okay. I'll go with that.
Okay, so science fiction is fantasy. But fantasy is not necessarily science fiction.
If it's a higher level category, but what if we were just talking about...
it's a taxonomy.
Yeah.
I'm arguing with a teacher. Me being a high school dropout, I shouldn't do that. But go on.
No, I think it's a good place to leave it. I mean, it all has to do with.
Do me a favor. Move your mic just a little so you're not talking directly into it.
Right over here. All right.
Yeah, just so you're not popping your P's.
Gotcha. I do like to pop my P's.
And everybody does.
Snake my S's.
Not on the air. Don't snake your S on the air.
Well. They can't see me snaking my asses.
That's true. That's true. But
it's funny. For the very first time, actually, I got to teach science fiction in my class. My students, most of my students are ESL students, which means they are English. They speak English as their second language, or sometimes their third, which is why
What level do you teach?
Oh, what level? We don't separate it by level. We separate it by grades. Right? What? So this year I'm teaching fifth grade.
Okay.
And every grade is a classroom.
Well,
if you're talking about middle school and high school, then you would have different levels. You could have different levels.
Oh, I see. Right.
Yeah, but elementary, right. It's K-5. They don't really mix it that much.
Yeah.
But I was able to teach science fiction for the very first time because we actually had novels we were talking about that actually did involve science fiction. Nothing, quite frankly, that I really wanted to teach. Bill Gates wrote a book with somebody else, and it was called, oh my goodness, I'm going to forget this on the air, name of this book. It'll come back to me a little bit. But basically, it's George's Secret Key to the Universe. It's actually has a sequel, too, basically about this character named George whose parents are Luddites, ends up living next to a scientist who was trained by an alien, who gave him this magical computer, basically, that allows him to basically punch holes in the universe, make his own wormholes, and then go to different places, go to different planets. But this is written by Bill Gates.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
He may very well have. I know he reads the stuff.
Yeah, but it wasn't bad, but it's not really what I would have wanted to teach. There's a lot more that's out there. Quite frankly, I would like to pull some of my friends and say, hey, why don't we get you into this classroom to start teaching. As a matter of fact, actually, when I was teaching fourth grade, we were doing a unit on fairy tales, and I got Delia Sherman to come in and talk to my students and read from her books.
You could not have done better.
Yeah, it's great. They loved it.
Yeah. Well, how could they not, huh?
Afterwards, actually, I took some of the best stories, and I put them to a book of fairy tales for her as a gift so she could take that experience with her.
Very good. Yeah. Very good. But at any rate, the there was a point when the arguments over the taxonomy of fantastic literature, mm-hmm. which is as good a name for all of it.
I like that term more, actually, now that I think about fantastic literature.
Yeah. Yeah. Or even fantastical. I don't think there is such a word, but in a way that I guess there is, because historical. But it's a useful term. But people would get down to the taxonomy. It was very important once upon a time to distinguish sci-fi from SF. Because sci-fi specifically referred to bad science fiction. It specifically referred to monster movies.
Which may be a reason why my mom always tells me she doesn't read science fiction.
Uh-huh. And, of course, she does.
And doesn't know it.
Yes, and that's always the case. And I always, you know, look at people. And this is the, you know, especially in days of yore, the usual argument would be that somebody would say, well, they don't read science fiction. They've never read any science fiction. So you never read 1984 by George Orwell. Well, that's literature, would be their comeback. At which point I usually bite their ankle or something like that, not in a friendly manner.
Well, I'm trying to get my mom to ease into science fiction, fantasy, speculative fiction. We're currently rereading Kindred together, her in Rochester and me here in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And next time I see her, we're going to actually have a book talk
Kindred
about Kindred.
Kindred is written by
Octavia Butler.
Oh, okay.
Is there another one?
To listeners, there may very well be. Hmm. I know what you're talking about. Of course, but we are broadcasting almost as far as Rochester. No. We have about a 60-mile radius.
Yeah, you're not quite there.
So not quite there. Well, it depends. Very, very late at night, when I used to be on at 5 a.m., this could be heard in Philadelphia.
Still not close.
It's still not close. Rochester's all the way up there and all the way west.
Yeah, for those people who are New Yorkers who think that Rochester is close to Rockland County, I'll just tell you it's about 700 miles away, just about an hour and a half east of Buffalo, New York.
It has the same first three letters. Yeah, yeah. Buffalo is as far as one can go, pretty much. Mm-hmm. If you step over the line in Buffalo, you're in Canada. Well, swimming anyway.
Yeah. Dip a toe when you're there.
Yeah, pretty much. Who am you?
Sorry, Yoda, what?
Who, exactly. Who are you?
My name is Cameron Roberson. I go by, you know what? I got myself the same way that I got you. So let's try this again. I am Rob Cameron.
Because you're in here in your capacity as a science fiction writer.
Yes. When I step behind the camera, or if I'm stepping in front of students, so if you meet me on the street, you can call me Cameron.
Okay. So when you say that you're teaching, say, fifth grade,
mm-hmm.
I assume that fifth grade today, as in my day, is one teacher for the whole day. You don't shift.
I do. I shift.
Oh, really?
So there are two different kinds of ENL or ESL teachers here in New York City. There are the push-in model, or there's the self-contained. Self-contained is where you have the students for all day, the same students. But I am a push-in teacher, which means I service about 90 students. I go into three different classrooms.
Oh, cool. Okay, so you sort of float
yes.
from class to class,
which is
with specialty.
Yeah, I mean, it's good in the way that I get to work with more students. Like, it's a little, it can be fun, but also I lose control because I'm going into somebody else's classroom. So every year, depending on who I'm working with, the working relationship changes from year to year.
Yeah, but you see, I like that idea because as a very disgruntled student, therefore the high school dropout, I never finished ninth grade. I'm quite serious. I never finished ninth grade.
Well, if you were one of my students, we would have met after I got you a beer when you turned 18.
Yeah, somebody actually, a judge once issued me a diploma, and I sort of rejected it.
Okay.
Because after that, after so many years, what was the point? I was over 40 at that point, so why change then? I'd already taught college level. Non-accredited, I should mention, but I did teach a course at Queens College.
Nice.
And also up at Goddard College in Vermont. And you were teaching science fiction. I, on the other side of the age line, was flunked out of a sixth grade class by the one teacher. We had no such matriculation, as it were, in those years. You had one teacher for the, you didn't see anybody else unless the teacher was out sick or with a sprained shoulder or something. They would say, I digressed myself.
Don't.
I got flunked because my book report was a novel by Ray Bradbury.
Huh. Because you're writing about those bad books, those books that aren't really telling anything.
Yeah. Exactly. It's junk. It's not literature.
No.
It was not considered as such. And
it's heathenistic.
Just choosing that, he didn't even read the book review. He just flunked me. And I had the ultimate revenge. The ultimate revenge is having Ray Bradbury record something that on cassette that I sent to the teacher. That's like Wet Dream, Rodney Dangerfield type movie.
Wait, can you say Wet Dream on the radio?
You can say it. You just can't do it.
Yes, but let me leave first.
Now, yes, exactly, because the studio gets awfully slippery. But the...
Is there a drum roll?
But
or a wet nap.
I actually have a little rim shot device. it has boo, applause, a rim shot, and crickets that somebody gave me. And I used to carry it just for just that purpose, so I could say something like that. And then, and it was great. The problem is I carry it in this pouch bag that I've got. Uh-huh. And I would lean that bag against something, and at the most inappropriate point, something would, hit something. Somebody would say something, and if I moved in the wrong way against the bag, you'd hear this chorus of boos coming out. Just boo! That was not cool. That was not cool. So as a writer of imaginative literature, fantastical literature, where do people find Rob Cameron and can read and listen to?
Ah, okay. Well, to find my story in its text form, you can buy The Clockwork Phoenix 5, which is a anthology of amazing and strange and weird stories, edited by Mike Allen. You can also find my story on his website at...
it is online.
Yep, Mythic Delirium. It is one of the featured stories on his website. And if you go to kaleidocast.nyc, episode 7, you'll find my story amongst the other amazing stories that have been read there on our podcast.
Pray tell, Rob, what is Kaleidocast?
Oh, that's great. No, I wish I brought the audio intro.
No. We don't need that. We just need to tell people.
Wow. I still wish I brought it with me anyway.
I could play it right now, but there's no point.
Just to have it on because I know it's my pocket, you know, it's a little bit like a comfort blanket, security blanket. But so KaleidoCast is a story podcast presented by the Brooklyn Speculative Fiction Writers, getting ready for a second season. The idea behind KaleidoCast is to put together every season, every episode, two kinds of stories. One from a already well known excellent writer, someone like, for example, N.K. Jemisin. Or Fenderson Jelly Clark, and pair them with one of our member writers from Brooklyn Speculative Fiction Writers who have written at a professional level. So we use the well-known writers as kind of the finish line. If you can write this well, you deserve to be published. And, you know, very often, there are many podcasts out there, there are many stories out there, really good ones that still don't find a home in the air. So we want to be another home for those people, for those writers.
Yeah.
So that's the reason why we do it. The premise is...
Well, what you really are, if I may say so, is a new publishing platform.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we are. So I will repeat that. We are a new publishing platform. And, like, the premise, the story behind it is all the... We have characters, and these characters are
academics. You're not only popping your P's now, you're popping your C's.
Really?
Yeah.
How about I talk like this?
Your mic placement is fine, but just face me.
Okay. So we have reoccurring characters in what we call our meta stories, which for every episode, we connect all the different stories with these 5 to 6 minute little mini stories that carries through the entire season. And so these characters live in a meta Brooklyn, a made up Brooklyn. I looked up a different dimension, and the stories that we publish are in some way finding physical form in this meta Brooklyn. So it could be in the form of a an alligator swimming up the Gowanus Canal.
And another reason the pairing of you and Delia are so perfect, because she is this meta New York that she did for, was it Freedom Maze?
For Freedom Maze?
No. Her book before that. Well, suffice it, she...
Oh, you mean the one in Central Park, with the fairies in Central Park?
Yes, and she had a whole map of New York in there.
Orb, yeah. So those characters, they kind of carry the story forward as they try to figure out where these stories are coming from, what to classify them as, you know, what happens in these, what does the physical form of these stories, what effect do they have on our Brooklyn? Because they change the very landscape of Brooklyn when we find them, and the people who live there. So that's the premise behind it. So hopefully we do a good job with that for season two. Season one, I'm pretty proud of. We had some great writers. Every episode I'm very happy with. I am particularly, though, I gotta say, happy with the episode with S.A. Chakraborty, her story, Baladi, which is the story of an Egyptian river spirit, the Nile River spirit, coming to life during the rebellion, recent rebellion there. It's
a particularly good story.
It's one of my favorite stories of all time. And I'm glad that she was able, that she brought it to us. We also, we workshopped that story too. So I knew that was good before it showed up. But then, well, Shan's a special kind of writer.
Yeah, too bad people, you know, can't just go somewhere and see her read.
I don't know. Somebody should fix that, you know?
Yeah, well, we're going to talk about that in just a moment. But first, there are two readings we have to promote and then you have to read.
Okay.
Yourself. So the readings are, first of all, Datlo is having one of her huge events, and this one is particularly good. It's this Saturday, January 7th at 6 p.m., and she has a new anthology called Bestiary.
Yes.
And the readers, get this, the readers are Jack Ketchum, who read for us in October, Sonia Tafe,
yep,
who read for us in April and November, and Michael Swanwick, who read for us a year ago September and many times before that, and I have a cunning way to work him in later this year, if he is available for the date. Maria Devana Headley, who read with Terrence Taylor in January. And Alyssa Quitney, who read for us a short story written by her father, along with Michael Swanwick. And that was 2 years ago that we had her. But I know Alyssa through Ellen Dadlow. And Alyssa Quitney's father, by the way, is a gentleman by the name of Robert Sheckley, one of my favorite writers of absolute all time. And Alyssa Quitney and Ziva Quitney, her mother, and Sheckley's third wife, third out of five, I believe. There's the multi-married clubs within science fiction that include Sheckley and Ellison and, well, lots of folk. But Alyssa Quitney is a fine writer in her own right. And I believe she is editor, of a major comics line. A major comics line. I don't remember which it is. It's terrible because I don't know my comics very well. Is it Vertigo? She's co-written any number of issues of Sandman with Neil Gaiman.
Wow.
Yeah, so you know, she dabbles. She dabbles. And she's Neil's comics editor. Not minor. So that's this coming Saturday at 6 p.m., Best Jerry, and where is it?
It's in a museum, I forget.
Yeah, and in Ellen's email missive, she really failed, because I didn't print it out, which I should have. She failed to print the thing, but there's a link here, so let me go to it. Yes, open it with Chrome. You're an Android. Open it with Chrome for bleep's sake. UnitedPhotoIndustries.com? Really? Here we are. Yes, menu. That's... Victor Cohn's Bestiary. Okay, da-da-da-da-da-da. Tin types. Okay, it's showing me all these fabulous photographs. But again, do you have an address?
Looking right now.
Yeah, I'm trying to look it up. No, it's not this place in Dumbo.
No, it's in Manhattan.
Yeah, it's in Manhattan in a venue that is not generally... No, it is in Dumbo. It is in Dumbo. United Photo Industries Gallery, 16 Main Street in Dumbo, Brooklyn.
Well, I'm glad I got that right wrong in the air.
Yeah. Okay. But I had to take the photograph that she included and blow it up all the way on my teensy little 4-inch phone in order to work that out. So, but you know what? Go to datlow.com. And just look it up, DATLOW. And that is a fine all-star reading. Now, then there are the New Voices and the other reading series that Ellen Dadlow and Matt Kressel do not run, although this isn't part of the KGB Fantastic Fiction series that Ellen runs, but this is a book launch. So this coming Tuesday, for the opening event of the New York Review of Science Fiction's second half of its 2016-2017 26th annual season, Rob here is the guest curator, and I am delighted that he has chosen three people, two of whom I had not heard of. I had not heard of Fenderson Djeli Clark yet, although I have since, because I managed to edit a short story of his for Lightspeed magazine. And Shan, I'm doing this without looking, so pray for me. Chakraborty?
Outstanding. You got it.
Yeah, except I was always saying Sean because I didn't look. I just saw S-H-A-N.
Sure. Well,
people... so I assume that this is like a name of certain derivation. And then I found out that he is a sure. Irish woman.
Well, the if
well, people, half Irish.
If people are Googling her, looking for her, she you'll find her as S.A. Chakraborty.
Mm-hmm. Actually, Shan also works to Google her. But so these are, I was pinning down Rob before we went on the air that I wanted a nice brief sort of lead, that's L-E-D-E, for the evening. And we came up with New American Writers because I didn't want to type it.
Oh, it was New American Voices.
Right? New American Voices yeah. in science fiction fantasy. Mm-hmm. And... thank you. I'll need to actually make a physical note of that. But before I type it in, I haven't done the all the Facebook publicity sure. and stuff like that yet. But I did print out the bios. And then, in addition, we have sort of a guest star, or a guest performer, as it were, uh-huh. a participant, a yes. guest participant. A gentleman who I've tried to have on the program, but we kept sort of like crossing paths in the wrong direction. His name is Harris Durrani, mm-hmm. H-A-R-I-S. Mm-hmm. So not a typical way of spelling Harris, D-U-R-A-N-I.
Two R's.
Two R's. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going by memory, but fine. And he's just a fascinating, fascinating, wonderful person, and he will be with Rob and the and Shan and Fen will be having a conversation about where these new voices are coming from
and where they're going to go
and where they're going to
where we're going with them.
You know, I printed this out, I put it in my bag, it's not here. So basically well, they're new voices.
Yeah, well, it's always funny. Whenever we say that, when someone makes it, right, and so now they're reading their stories or re-getting their stories in books now, they're new to many people, but they've been working and they've been around for a while.
Oh, yeah.
Like Fenderson has been, I've known Fenderson for, gosh, now I'm going to say like 5 or 6 years. And he's an academic. He's been writing. He's been like published like around since
now,
around 2010.
I sent you at least 2 or 3 emails on yeah. the pronunciation. On pronunciation.
What did I say just now?
Dejeli.
I said, I've been going back and forth. Jelly.
Dejeli.
Dejeli.
Dejeli is what we officially went with on Lightspeed Magazine.
Okay.
But what our guest host, by name of Terrence Taylor, but it was John Joseph Adams, was dealing with the pronunciation. Our editor was dealing with the pronunciation by email.
Right.
And he simply did what I always do, is you go to Google and you type in pronounce, and then you put in the name. And... more places than not had Dejeli or Geely sometimes.
Right. Well, often he'll just go by.
Apparently, he said there are several ways yeah. to do it, and that one's good.
Yeah. Or oftentimes he'll just say, you know, the D and keep on going to his last name, Clark, which everybody gets. But he's been, besides his academic work, he's been publishing even like short stories on very specific like Griot work, you know, things about the African-American diaspora tint to it. And everything I've ever read from him has been brilliant and tight.
So. His story in last month's, technically it was Fantasy Magazine, which mm-hmm. is technically a dead magazine, but we haul it out once a year now at Lightspeed. It's folded into Lightspeed Magazine. Nightmare is still its own magazine with where we have a podcast every 2 weeks. Lightspeed is weekly. I say we because I am the audio editor and host of Lightspeed Magazine. But then we do special issues for the last 3 years. This year was People of Color Destroy for Science Fiction. In
how many times has science fiction been destroyed in the last
3 times?
Years?
3 times. It started with women. Women destroy science fiction, then queers destroy science fiction, mm-hmm. and then people of color destroy science fiction. I had great objections to queers destroy science fiction, Because A, I'm not fond, being old school, I'm not fond of the Q word. When I was growing up, it was a derogatory term, never to be used in anything but a derogatory manner. And people say, oh, we've reclaimed. And I say, yeah, after the next 4 years, let's see how reclaimed it really is and how many people are using it in a horrible negative way. And so I don't care for that. Then destroy. You're not destroying it. You're creating it. Some idiot blogger, truly idiotic, rabid blogger, was saying, well, women are destroying science fiction. So John came back with, okay, women destroy science fiction. And so that's where the destruction came from. And I'm going, but no, they're creating it. And then science fiction, it was fantasy. They were doing fantasy and horror stories. So, queers, no. Destroy, no. Science fiction, no. But they were all great stories, so who gives a bleep?
No one.
No one. So, if you... So, but we did have POCDF, People of Color Destroy Fantasy, when special issue of Fantasy Magazine, which is folded into Lightspeed, but online, if you go to... FantasyMagazine.com.
They have three different ones. They didn't mix them up. There's People of Color Destroy Fantasy, People of Color Destroy Science Fiction, and People of Color Destroy Horror. They had three. They separated them.
They separate them, and they are together. You can buy a single magazine with all three folded into one.
Cool.
Or you can online partake of them singly in three different sessions.
I get them in the mail, in my email.
Oh, very good. Mm-hmm. Very good. And we're glad you do. But do you listen to the podcasts?
I guess now I have to.
You know, I've been hosting it for 3 years now, right?
Sorry?
I've been the host for 3 years now.
Oh, and that was definitely on my agenda.
Jeez. No, I've been the host for 2 years now. I was the audio editor for 3 years. I only took over as host... No, I started as those, what I'm saying. No, 3 years. 3 years. I get confused. It's been a while. And working with the same people, I do other projects as well. So it gets a little bit confusing. I just finished 2 audiobooks.
And we've just had some cider and bourbon. So.
Ah, piffle. So that's this coming Tuesday. In where we are right now, you can get online right now, stand outside 388 Atlantic Avenue. Well, we're on the third floor. You want to come to the main floor, to the Brooklyn Commons Cafe at 388 Atlantic Avenue, on Atlantic between, Hoyt and Bond, I believe. It's a lovely space with perfectly nice food. Admission is free, but... we will try puppy eyes on you to get you to donate on your way in. We'll do worse than puppy eyes. And we'll try to get you to donate. And a great time will be had. This is, I'm really very happy to have such guest curators as Rob, because otherwise, yeah, I know a lot of people, and I can bring in a lot of fine people. But I don't know them all, and my horizons don't get expanded without finding people who also know a lot of people. And Rob is very good at bird dogging for people I'm not familiar with. So this is a great way to come out and hear science fiction that you're not likely to find immediately in your bookshelves and bookstores or even Amazon. You have to hunt for them in places like Clark's World Magazine and Lightspeed and Nightmare and Beneath Ceaseless Skies. There are a lot of Kaleidocast and the Escape Artists. Mm-hmm. Which are Escape Pod,
Pseudopod,
and
Podcastle.
And Podcastle. You know, Barbara Krasnov actually was a reader, not a writer, a reader for Podcastle last week.
Did not know that.
Yes. just somebody thought that she had the right voice for the story, being a Brooklyn Jewish woman's story.
The small world.
So, well, she was actually somebody else introduced them, and they were giving Barbara all of these. There's a little ego boo for myself. All of these tips on how to record, and you know, did she know anybody who could edit? And she said, "Well, my partner does editing and stuff, Jim Freund." And they said, oh, "Well, then it's all taken care of." I thought we did an adequate job. Now, her reading was fine in terms of the quality of the recording, but that's a whole, yeah, that's a whole other story. I have to build a studio.
Gotcha.
Claire Cooney and I were discussing the building of studios. It's an issue.
If you do, let me know.
I will, because I'm going to do it. It's just a question of when. I will be involving people that you know. The aforementioned...
Miss Cooney?
Terrence.
Oh, well, him too.
Yeah. Well, at any rate... So, again, this Tuesday... 7 o'clock, show up at 6:30 in order to warm yourself up with some hot cider or kombucha or they also have very good food.
Yes, they do.
It's yeah. Quite good food.
Yeah.
I recommend dinner at intermission.
Well, come and get it quick because we're gonna start at 7 o'clock sharp. And
you think?
Oh, yes.
I'll decide when we start. It's usually about 7:10. You know that because you've engineered them.
Yeah.
And this time, be very, very, very afraid.
Why is that?
I'm your engineer.
Oh, no.
It's my first time.
Hey, Terrence, are you going to be there just to pull the cord?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Terrence, I have never done what you did last month so well. I haven't done the graphics. I know how to set the camera, move the camera, switch from one camera to another, segue, and I certainly know the audio aspect of it. What I do not know are getting the graphics up on the screen, which I was very specific with you and Sam Schreiber about what I envision. But I've still never done it. I haven't. Every time we had training sessions, I get distracted by little things like dealing with the owner on booking dates and stuff like that, or certain things not working that I had to deal with. So,
well, I'm sure it'll
but be Terrence fine. Will be sitting next to me, so I have a safety net.
Good.
Because I need to learn this as well as you were trying to form a club of people that know how to operate. Oh, that's another thing we should mention to listeners. Now, you have to be here. You have to be here. There's no excuse. But if your excuse is something ridiculous, like you're in Bulgaria, as I know at least one regular listener is, or something like that, you can watch it on live stream. Which is what we've been talking about, the video aspect. I do not freaking believe about last month. I won't say it. You know what I'm talking about. That people were unaware that this was a video event.
Ah.
It's their third time that it was a video event. They forgot, that's all. Last April 5th, at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, we did a book launch party for Clockwork Phoenix 5, which my partner had a very good story in. It's an amazing anthology. There isn't a bad story in the bunch. And I was introduced to a whole lot of wonderful writers whose work I was unfamiliar with, like Shveta Thakrar and Sonia Taaffe. And it was the first time that I actually heard Rob, as opposed to Cam, read a story, and I was blown away by it.
Thank you.
And it's a fine, fine story and had a personal resonance for me. I don't know if I ever mentioned this to you because I grew up in Queens, in Jackson Heights.
No.
So I lived on the 7 train. I can, you play me a recording of something going on the 7 train, I'll tell you what stop you're at.
Yep.
And if you can bring me the scent. I remember when the Silver Cup Studios, now a major television and movie studio, I remember when the Silver Cup Bread Factory, and which is what it was. It's why its name, Silver Cup Bread, which was a local competitor to Wonder Bread. And when the 7 train passed that part in Long Island City, you could smell it for 3 stops. You could smell it from the stop before Queens Plaza, and Hunter's Point. And it was intoxicating. And I had many, many a fantasy as a child about taking that ride on the 7 train, and even later when WBAI was located on 62nd Street and 1st Avenue. That was also how I came in, unless I was taking the bus. But the 7 train, more than anything else, was my conduit to Manhattan. So
yeah,
the story Squeeze, its setting, gave me very strong visuals. And it should do that for you, the listener, even though you're not a 7 train rider.
But you could be.
Well, yes, if only to visit the venue of the story. So would you care to read it, Rob?
Oh, sure.
And I'm going to close my mic. I'm also going to refill your water.
Thank you. Anytime. Squeeze. Gone. 2 stolen, I messed with Texas shot glasses. Photos of us at your niece's graduation. Seashells you found in the middle of that parking lot in Great Neck. My empty Red Hot Chili Peppers CD cases. Your panties under my bed. High on grief after your funeral. I took everything imbued with your essence and shattered it against the wall, or burned it like witches at the stake, while the smoke detector screeched in short bursts. I stopped speaking to people. In the morning, I would dress myself, chin to chest, fumbling with buttons, head bowed like the lilies on your casket, and take the 7 train from Times Square to where you used to live in that ancient duplex on the corner of Cherry Avenue and Flushing, last stop. That's where we had chilled in your landlord's bleached porch swing with our feet up, drinking Red Stag whiskey in every kind of weather. That's where, in your own quiet way, you had tried to prepare me for the inevitable. Since you weren't there anymore, there was no reason to get off the train. So I'd wait for it to fill with bodies and ferry me back to Manhattan. Unable to move forward or go back, this became my life for maybe 100 years. Time moves differently on the 7. Passing under the Lethean waters of the East River, eroded my memory until I couldn't remember your face or the smell of your hair. Terrified, I listened for your voice, but it was lost in the dull roar of rush hour. One morning, as the train emerged at Vernon Boulevard in Queens, a stinging sensation struck the crown of my head, forcing my starving mind to aggressively adhere to the smallest, most perfect details which, while still of no interest to me, now could not be ignored. At Queensboro Plaza, light traveled broken paths through the scratched, stained window and became prismatic, oscillating streamers of blue, purple, and gold. Bruised tangerines scattered through space like cooling stars born from the bursting scarlet plastic bag of an elderly Chinese couple at Roosevelt, bloodying the air with their tart flavor. Squat graffitied rooftops were a fast-moving dream coming into focus while neck muscles tensed against the subtle pull of gravity as the train came to a full and complete stop at Junction Boulevard. The platform was crowded. Plump Ecuadorian children played soccer as their parents pressed shoulder to moist shoulder, forepositioned by my train car door, weighed down by toddlers, baby carriages, and carts. The doors shushed open and all of Queens flooded in, eager to escape the sharp briars of a New York summer. Everyone had an unhealthy metallic sheen to them, beaded with many vernal pools. The sudden influx of heat and mass made my teeth ache with stomach turning vertigo. And as my vision doubled, a little ghost boy slipped under the turnstile and appeared on the train. The doors shushed together, and we moved. The MTA kept the cars cold enough to retard the ammonia-producing chemistry of so many bodies. The chilled spot I heard you're supposed to feel around poltergeists didn't even register. The ghost child blinked in and out of existence. Every time he reappeared, I had to remember him all over again, like catching the tail of a fleeing dream. At first, I would be watching a square of light crinkle and color like tinfoil as it drifted through the car. Then a child would cry, and the light became the boy, going through people's bags or sitting on old women's laps. He pulled the pacifiers from beautiful sleeping brown babies and tried to lift them from their seats. He finger-painted messages from the dead in the grime on the window. Sometimes he used his face. He danced around the pole, singing at the top of his lungs, which sounded like the screech of the train wheels going round a turn at incautious speed. It's easy to imagine the ghosts of men than ghost children. Excuse me, it's easier. The two words in juxtaposition cry out for a comma between them, or a period, a division of ideas in the same way there should be a barrier between life and death. The lack of imagination is why people don't see him. In the same way, it is difficult for a young child to understand death, so sometimes they do not die. Although calling it a child might be misleading. The ghost looked right at me, one eye glaring white, while the other was a hole, impossibly deep. But I was not afraid. I wondered why I could see him when nobody else could. Then I remembered near-death experiences can shift your perspective. Losing you had almost killed me. The ghost child climbed up next to some woman, knelt backwards on the bench, and looked out the window while babbling. The woman had one arm. The other was gone at the elbow. I'd noticed her in the same way I noticed anyone on the subway. There was a process: awareness, speculation, judgment, and ignorance. Awareness. She was tall and brittle, skin made of a dark, distinctly non-native graphite. Her eyes were chips of tarnished bronze. I could tell she'd been more colorful once. Recent fossils show dinosaurs had feathers. There were imprints in the stone. Feathers meant color. She was like that, imprinted. Speculation. I imagined her homeland was once a happy place where everyone sang everything everywhere they went. It was Eden. It was Zamunda. It was the Lion King, but with real people. Then disaster struck. She'd escaped on a boat that was over capacity. It tipped, and she swam to shore through the floating bodies of loved ones and strangers. She'd survived and now rode my 7 train to the last stop. Judgment. I didn't like her because she would take up 2 seats, because she wasn't big enough or crazy enough to deserve 2 seats, because I looked at her and thought, bomber. Nigeria is experiencing a rash of female bombers, said some CNN breaking news update somewhere. I didn't like her because she wasn't you. Ignorance. After a while, she became background, and my eyes passed over her, flattening her like the ads for 1-800-Immigrant Legal Services I didn't need, surgical body hacks I couldn't afford, and postcard-sized notes stuck in the seams of the subway maps, warning of a wrathful second coming of Jesus I didn't believe in. I'm sure everybody noticed me in the same way. But all of a sudden, the woman slid over and made room for the ghost child. He turned, sat, and took her hand, or where her ghost limb would have been. She squeezed her other fist. But you could imagine. A small sound escaped from both her and my opened lips, and her body, which had been a desert, briefly flooded with color. She looked through me, eyes glistening with tears that welled but did not fall, and before I could blink them away, my vision blurred too. I realized we had been on the same commute now for years. She'd been squeezing her fist just like this, just like this evening at exactly this time between Junction and Flushing. Of course, she'd always been able to see him. I wondered what else she had lost along with her arm. I wondered what else she could see. Maybe it was a trick of my peripheral vision, but for a moment she and the ghost child shared an unmistakable resemblance. I suddenly found that I'd walked through the crowded train, and I was standing in front of her. "I see him too," I said. "The boy?" she asked, her voice carving out each syllable with precision. "I thought I was the only one," we said at the same time. "Is he your son?" I asked. I could tell she wanted to say yes, but instead, "I don't know what he is." We stood together in awkward silence, neither of us used to talking, while the train pulled into Flushing and emptied. "This is my stop," she said, walking past me. Then she turned back at the door. "How sad is it that we need the dead to connect to the living?" Which is something you would have said. The ghost boy was gone too, and I sat alone in my train car. But then it began to fill back up with people. "Tomorrow, we will talk again. If not tomorrow, then the next day. It will be another great adventure, like loving you, which was the same as facing death." Thank you.
Whew. So that was Squeeze by Rob Cameron, available in Clockwork Phoenix 5 or online at mythicdelirium.com. Have you your own website?
I do. It's rob-cameron.com.
Okay. So,
which will confuse people even more.
Nah. Or people can see you reading it.
Yeah, on the
You just heard it. Now watch the video.
Yeah. Which also I posted on my website at rob-cameron.
Oh, very good. Very good. Okay. So, it's quite a powerful story for somebody who hasn't published a great deal.
Appreciate that.
What else have you published, in fact?
This would be it.
That's it. Okay, so that is your premiere story.
Mm-hmm. I'm right now working on my novel, which, by the way, Shannon Chakraborty has helped to. She beta read for me. She's part of a writer's group, so she's had a chance to help me out with my story.
Okay, yeah. Very cool. And
S.A. Chakraborty.
Yes. Well, I think on the air calling her Shan is fine. That's what you call her to her face, is it not?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then good enough, close enough for radio. Now, what confuses me, there are at least three other major writers groups, spec fic writers groups in New York. There's the Altered Fluid Writers Group, mm-hmm. which is...
It's Matt, and that's NK, that's Danielle.
Well, yeah, but it's changed very much over the years. There are a lot of people who were in there who are gone.
Mm-hmm.
And there are new people in there that I don't yet know, which is fine. And they have, I guess, about 14 or 15 people. They, as a group, by the way, have been on this show about, I think, 7 times so far, the entire group. Mm-hmm. And it's something I very much want to do again. We can't do it in this room, obviously, but I have this idea of doing it downstairs at the Commons and possibly in front of a live audience, where the way that they work is somebody reads a story and then everybody gets two or three minutes to do crits, as that's
yep.
I mean, other people use that term, but, you know, criticism. And if somebody else just simply agrees with what somebody else has said, that person will just say ditto to save time, and stuff like that. So that's one writer's group. Then there's the Tabula Rasa writer's group, which used to be known as the, which transformed out of the 8th of February writer's group, so-called, because the 8th of February is Jules Verne's birthday. And that actually has at least one person in common with Altered Fluid, that being Rick Bowes. And they work in a slightly different manner than Altered Fluid. Altered Fluid allows for novel vetting and certain things like that. At this point, now they do. They started with short stories only. Tabula Rasa just does formally short stories. And if you have a novel that you want people to read, then you do like what you've been doing, is you get a beta reader. Mm-hmm. Then there's another group that I won't mention because they are a closed group. Gee, now that she's not in New York, I'm not sure who else in the group is. I know it still exists. It's called Circle in the Hair, CITH. And then there is, and that has like 6 people in it. Now, the Brooklyn Speculative Fiction Writers Group has a few more people.
Well, right. I mean, we grow with the size of our organizing. I call them staffs. Right now, we're about 265 members. Now, of those 265, I would say approximately a third of them are regularly, consistently coming. But what we do is very much off a lot of what you actually were talking about. So we use the Clarion method, which is that ditto that you're talking about.
We have to tell listeners what the Clarion method is.
So Clarion method of critique is something that was developed, I think, by the Clarion Workshop in California. I think it originally was somewhere in the Midwest, but now...
Actually, originally it was in Clarion, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And then moved to a different place in Pennsylvania. Then there was Michigan, then Clarion West in 1973 and 75, and there's Clarion South in Australia.
Right. Well, the Clarion method, as you already said, is where people who are being critiqued basically sit in the box and listen and take notes and just pay attention without answering questions yet until everyone has had their time to give their critiques, 3 to 4 minutes, and then it gets open to question. Now, we do that.
We should mention that Clarion is a closed professional workshop, intense 6-week-long workshop.
Right. So we do that for both short story and for novel critiques, as well as a beta reading. So for our writers who have finished their novel, they finished it with the group, they will then put out a message saying, hey, does anyone want to beta read my story? Then we have 6 or 7 people say yes. They get 2 months to read the story, up to, and then we come back and we give a full critique of the entire book from beginning to end. We also have another method, which is very informal, non-formal method, where instead of everyone sitting in a circle and giving 4 minutes, because some people, quite frankly, aren't very, that makes them nervous having that kind of time to critique somebody else.
Yeah.
So we kind of start with just a basic conversation. Whoever feels comfortable starting it, the more extroverted, they'll start the conversation, and then it kind of builds into something, into a full conversation with the people who aren't so sure, able to chime in. But at still at the same time, the writer is still quiet for the majority of that. So we have all kinds of meetings like that. And that's why I think we have so many people in a writer's critique session, because there are that many organizers who are willing to do the work to help us all become professionals. I mean, that is the goal. When Brad Parks created the Brooklyn Speculative Fiction Writers, it was with the goal of becoming professional writers. And we have, at least now 20 of us, yeah, now who have published professionally. And Shan Chakraborty, S.A. Chakraborty, she's going to be our first our first writer, I think, to publish her novel professionally, a novel that has gone through the entire critique process with us. And
it's a sold book.
And it's a sold book. As a matter of fact, this was one of the...
Coming out this year.
Yep, coming out in the fall. It was one of the it was called one of the biggest actually deals of last year, like a 6-figure deal. It's amazing.
Whoa.
Yeah.
In science fiction, that's unusual.
Yeah. But it's on the strength of the book. I mean, one of the things that she
does. Who's the publisher?
The publisher is, my goodness, I have this off the top of my head.
Yeah, and as I say, I printed this all out.
Yeah. So I will definitely make
sure. 6 figures. I doubt it's. Well, I was going to say. that much. Yeah. I found it. I found it.
Yeah.
Let's see. Blah, blah, blah. I don't know how to pronounce it. Davabad?
You're asking for the name of the book.
Harper.
Yeah, Harper Collins. Yeah.
Harper Voyager.
Harper Voyager. Excuse me. We're getting these mistakes all over the place. I'm glad someone is here to correct
me. Not Harper and Row, not Harper Collins.
It is
Harper Voyager.
Thank you, Harper Voyager. But one of the things that I think that you know, we were having a conversation more than a month ago about what do we do now, this new environment? You know, why are these new voices so important? Science fiction. What she does is she threads that needle. She gets right that whole world, something is mainstream at the same time, brings you something that's new and that people need to read. And is, you know, it's unthreatening in a way that I think people who are of, let's say, they're not of the norm science fiction readers, they're not of the norm people who will look at somebody from with Shan's background, or people, or even the culture that she's talking about with that background. It makes it easier to understand them and to humanize with them, because the story is that good, and the writing is that good, the characterization is that good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it brings people in whether they want to or not.
Yeah. I see Shan is from Queens. Yeah. Where did your story? I mean, you know, the Seven Train. You're rather intimate with it. You don't live. Were you in Queens at one point?
When I first moved to New York City, I lived in Queens. I was in Flushing, then I was in Forest Hills.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, that house in Sherry and Sherry.
Ah, okay. Yeah. No, I was from Jackson Heights. Mm. So Roosevelt, well, actually the 82nd Street stop on the 7, but Roosevelt Avenue, I'd usually walk there because so many different trains stop there.
Yeah.
Train lines that don't exist anymore, like the double R and the double E.
Yeah.
Long forgotten New York trivia now.
Yeah, one of my coworkers, he's a map enthusiast. He was explaining to me all different systems of subways that New York City went through before they finally got to where we are now.
Yeah, the one that really kills me is, and I had to do this just last week, is the transfer in Brooklyn from, what's the station called? I think it's called 9th Street on the R train.
And near the F and the R?
It's the F and the R.
Yep.
You go from the R to the F.
Mm-hmm.
You're going vertically up, I don't know, more than 100 feet.
Yeah.
It is a lot of staircases. And that's because, but you get to one point and you can see where there's one subway station and there's been a wall broken down and there's another. And one is the BMT. The Brooklyn-Manhattan Transit and the Interborough Rapid Transit, the BMT and the IRT.
Huh.
And now I'm forgetting, what was the third? There were three lines, the BMT, the IRT, and...
Can't help you.
I'm not going to take listener calls about it, but you know what I'm going to start doing? I'm going to set up a special... Twitter account. I actually have an Hour of the Wolf Twitter account that I never use. And I'll tell people that they can tweet or hashtag or something like that. And I'll pick it up if they can answer the questions. The BMT, the IRT. Yeah. And there was a third. There was a third. Oh, the IND, the Independent.
Which went?
independently. You know, I don't remember them all anymore. But it was really a question simply of which company owned that particular one. And there were issues of getting the gauge of the rail when New York City bought them all. Probably, I guess, about 1905, about the same time that Brooklyn became a part of New York. And everything was meshed together.
Okay.
I'm guessing. I don't know. It's hard to believe that we have like 2.5 minutes left. Yeah. I told you, time flies. Time flies on this show. Especially when I'm rambling on and being all forgetful. Lister, thank you for last week's show. We did our annual Council of Elrond broadcast, and that runs about 94 minutes. So with intro and outro, the show run, well, this is a 90-minute time slot, and we ran about 100 minutes. So 100 an hour, 112 minutes to be precise. And so I am deeply indebted to Lister for donating some of his airtime once again to help that happen. And thereby, I command you, the listener, to stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming your way in just a few minutes. I also cajole you to visit, was it Rob-Cameron.com. Thank God it isn't like .com or something like that. That would just drive me lunatic. You can also, don't visit ourwolf.com unless you want to look up the schedule for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. So the rest of the website is very 90s. It's very 90s. It needs a major boost and upgrade, but I'm not going with blogware. Sorry, no WordPress for me. And I like HTML. And Facebook, there's an Hour of the Wolf book on Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook. Mm-hmm. There's a New York Review of Science Fiction Readings group on Facebook.
Well, Brooklyn Speculative Fiction Writers page is also in there, so you can like us there too.
Right, and Kaleidocast
is also on there.
So, all of you at home have your assignments. And we are not going to quiz you if you show up this coming Tuesday before 7 p.m. at 388 Atlantic Avenue for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, which Rob will be the guest curator of this week and this month, I should say, with Fenderson DeJelly Clark and S.A. Chakraborty and Harris Durrani in discussion. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be different. It's going to be good is what it's going to be. So I hope that you can all be there. Thank you for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I will be back next week from 1:30 to 3 a.m. with an agenda to be determined. I know that we're going to be having specific stuff, a lot of books coming out in February, and a lot of writers who are going to be here to promote those. In the meantime, be good to each other. You deserve it. We deserve it. And we're all going to need a lot of soothing this year to get over 2016 and to gird our loins for 2017. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you for having me, Jim.
Thank you, Cam.
Thank you for having me, Jim.
Bingo, you got the line. And thank you all. Have a great morning. Take care.
people remember I said with the last words on my lips, I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to spell it. I am a proletarian. I am
the fish. The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth that's off the way I see it? Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people all around the pig lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, though that's my right, and it's right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover.
Just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why? the flag. I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
Yeah. 99 Sync, a list alive. W-B-A-I. 5 minutes after flag burning time, right here at 99 Sync, W-B-A-I. Clappers. Thank you very much, Jim Freund. Good to see you back here in the New Year 2017.
Yes.
Great show, Jim. Great reading this morning. 99 Sinker. The vanguard of the Pacifica system. List Alive. Carl Dix in Washington, D.C. Until we overthrow the system, y'all.
If you feel like you have me wrapped up around your little finger, you're wrong. And everybody feel as if you lick me chip and I'm programmed to you. Think of you alone can love me and I'll be broken if you walk out. But anytime you decide to pack up your things and leave, don't come back. Don't come back. I won't cry, I'll be fine. Don't come back. Oh, don't come back. No matter make you do a ritual where the good Lord splits ya. Don't come back.
Life is real, this love is gone toxic and a poison weed. No need to play any games anymore. You're kinda loving and not loving to me. Drifting now, we're drifting. Remember when we were one? This ship is sinking. If we don't bail out, we're gonna drown. My cup is overflowing.
Perfect nails, and you can't afford a car. Everything's good, but she forgot to put sparkles in her eyes. In her
gotta say, she looks nice with her brand new hairstyle. I gotta say that she looks good in that new dress. She just bought perfect makeup, perfect nails, and you can't afford a car. Everything's good, but she forgot to put sparkles in her eyes. In her eyes. Gotta say, she looks nice with her brand new hairstyle. I gotta say that she looks good in that new dress. She just bought perfect makeup, perfect nails, and you can't afford a car. Everything's good, but she forgot to put sparkles in her eyes.
Baby, just to know that I'm in love with you. Baby, I'm satisfied and I'm tickled too. Baby, just to know that I'm in love with you. Baby, now, sugar, I've been. Pocket full of tin. Hear my money jingling. Sugar, I'm going downtown with my hat caved in. I'm coming back home to you, darling, with a pocket full of tin. Oh, money done changed. And baby, Rooster, you don't come around my chicken shack as much as you used to, Rooster. Well, a little red hen said to the little red rooster, Rooster, you don't come around my chicken shack as much as you used to, Rooster. Oh, I love you, sweet mama, now, baby, now you're the one. You put your arms around me, baby, light a circle around the sun. I love you, pretty mama, now, baby, you're the one. You put your arms around me now, baby, like the circle around the sun.